SP Audio is today talking to Mr. Jason Tuan, who's a vascular surgeon at Austin Health, Eastern Health and Epworth, based in Melbourne, and has appointments at University of Melbourne and Monash University. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Excellent. So there are two, you're one of the authors of two articles in the June 2013 edition of Australian Family Physician looking at aneurysms, one particularly focusing on aortic aneurysms and one on non-aortic aneurysms. And we might focus today particularly on the aortic aneurysms. So we all know that a ruptured aneurysm is a serious and often fatal condition. Can you tell us a bit about the natural history of aortic aneurysms?
Well, Carolyn, abdominal aortic aneurysms are probably the most common presentation of aortic aneurysms. We know that they're generally very slow growing, and even by the time they are picked up, which is usually incidentally, they will have been present over a very long period of time. In most cases, the patients will have had no symptoms whatsoever, and the aneurysms usually remain indolent until the patient either dies of another condition or they develop pain from rupture, which at that point the situation is already a medical emergency. What we do know is that the behaviour of these aneurysms changes based on their size. So small aneurysms, which is aneurysms between 3 and 5 centimetres, usually grow very slowly in the order of around 2 millimetres a year. We've had quite extensive information about these patients with small aneurysms. There was a large UK small aneurysm trial which was conducted in the 1990s. And that established quite comprehensively that the risk of rupture of a small aneurysm less than 5 centimetres in size was in the order of less than 1% per year. We do know that of those who are kept under regular surveillance in this group, that anywhere up to 60 to 70% may well go on to have surgery. And the reason for this is that we generally will offer patients with aneurysms greater than 5 centimetres surgery based on previous experience. And in that trial, the cutoff at 5 centimetres was when patients were offered surgery.
Yep.
In terms of what happens over 5 centimetres or up to 5.5 centimetres in size, we're a little bit unclear. But traditionally, because we offer surgery at that point, there's a relative paucity of information about what happens to patients in that larger range group. Historically, from studies going back to the 1950s and 60s, we believe that aneurysms that are 6 centimetres or greater have around a 10% per year rupture risk, and we also project that that will increase dramatically as those aneurysms get larger. In fact, one of my senior colleagues used to say that a 4 centimetre aneurysm should have surgery tomorrow, a 5 centimetre aneurysm should have surgery today, and a 6 centimetre aneurysm should have had surgery yesterday.
It's a nice easy way to remember things. And so the article makes the point that currently in Australia there are no screening programs for AAAs, unlike in some other countries. What are some of the risk factors for AAA that we know of?
The strongest risk factors that we know about that are associated with AAAs are history of smoking and male gender, and also advanced age. It's pretty obvious that children are unlikely to have aneurysms, but realistically we're talking about patients over the age of 60 or 65. And that's the basis of most screening studies in the US, the UK and Sweden, where effectively being male and a history of smoking and over the age of 65 will qualify you for a screening study. The other risk factors include a family history of thoracic or abdominal aortic aneurysms, other cardiovascular risk factors, and if a patient has multiple risk factors, then obviously their risk or their likelihood of having an aneurysm is increased. In terms of the situation with screening in Australia, there's no formal or funded screening programs, but there's nothing to stop GPs from ordering a screening ultrasound scan if they deem it appropriate. We know that from other screening studies that the greater your pretest probability is, the greater the potential yield there is from screening. And that's why untargeted screenings, such as some of the private and self-paid CT and ultrasound screening programs that we've seen in the news recently, promoting themselves of very limited value.
Yep. And so, as you point out, we know what the risk, well, we know what some of the risk factors are, and particularly targeting can improve cost effectiveness and the like. You've sort of already mentioned a little bit about if a AAA is found, what's the management, because we talked a bit about rupture risk and particularly timing of operations of 6 centimetres yesterday, 5 centimetres now. What sort of are the other elements, if you do find a smaller AAA, about how do you follow those up and what sort of things do you try and manage in the whilst with a smaller AAA?
What we often find is that once patients are informed that they have an aneurysm, they get quite nervous. So the most important thing for the patient is that they get good advice from the outset. We have seen patients that basically panic when they've been told that they have a time bomb in their abdomen that could burst at any stage. That's probably a little bit of an unfair statement on patients. It pretty much stops them from sleeping at night and doesn't really do them much good. The fact is that the risk of rupture of a small aneurysm is very low, and you can view that as 1% per year, or you could view that as a 99% likelihood that nothing's going to happen that year. And in the first instance, that risk is significantly lower than the immediate risk of death from surgery. So the justification for sending patients immediately for surgery once they've been diagnosed is fairly low. So my message would probably be that once a patient is diagnosed with a small aneurysm, that they get appropriate advice. And if that advice can be reliably provided by the GP, then there's no need immediately to be referred to a vascular surgeon. But if the GP is uncomfortable or the patient requests more information, then a vascular surgical referral is very much worthwhile. In terms of what happens after that, regular surveillance is quite important. And in our paper, we suggest some regular screening intervals based on the size of an aneurysm. And effectively, that is correlated with the likelihood that patient will progress to have surgery within the...
Yeah, and one of the things that, from a GP perspective, we can do is if people are having surveillance, being clear about who's organising it, if they're seeing a surgeon or whether it's us, and using our recall systems as a backup to make sure that people don't disappear and fall off some of those systems that occasionally happen.
Yes, that's quite right. I'd say that's quite right. We do see significant numbers of patients who essentially get lost to follow-up because of poor communication as to who's going to be conducting that surveillance. And where GPs have good programs and are happy to do that, then I think that's fine for them to do that. And where they don't feel comfortable doing that, then most vascular surgeons will have established surveillance programs of their own.
Indeed. The other point that it mentions is about cardiovascular risk factor management, which is something we're all relatively relatively confident with. So it's all the things like lifestyle advice, smoking cessation, and other cardiovascular risk factor advice and pharmacotherapy that can be helpful as well. Is that more about, I'll say, decreasing overall cardiovascular mortality, or is it also about changing the AAA risk?
We don't have a great deal of data in terms of the effect of pharmacotherapy on aneurysm growth. There certainly has been some work in terms of antibiotic use such as doxycycline or the effect of beta blockers on aneurysm growth, but that's really not mainstream practice in terms of trying to modify the growth rate of an aneurysm. But you're quite right, Carolyn, that these patients will typically have cardiovascular risk factors. They will generally be at elevated risk of cardiovascular events, such as MI or stroke, as a result of this. And it's important that the treating doctors aren't distracted by the fact that there is an aneurysm and deal with the underlying cardiovascular risk. So I think that teamwork between GP specialists, whether that be a surgeon or otherwise, is quite important.
Indeed. Now, the article talks about imaging and makes the point that ultrasound is the one used usually for diagnosis and screening, and others may have roles around surgery or planning for surgery and intervention. When we get an ultrasound report that mentions a AAA, what is the most important bit for us to act or to base our decisions on?
The ultrasounds are great because they're non-invasive, they're pretty cheap, and they're very easily repeated and reproduced. The things we find is that sometimes when patients have ultrasounds done, then a flurry of figures gets mentioned in the reporting, and that's because the standard reporting mechanism for finding an abdominal mass is to report, say, the AP diameter, the side-to-side lateral diameter, and then the length. Now, for an aneurysm, it's a tubular structure, essentially. The aorta is a tubular structure. So when you get a report of a 4 by 4.5 by 7 centimetre aneurysm, we'd be pretty confident that the 7 centimetre dimension is the length of the aneurysm, which really has no bearing on its risk. So we would report that as a 4 by 4.5 centimetre aneurysm. In patients who have complicated, angulated or tortuous aortas, then trying to get that accurate transverse measurement can be difficult and challenging for a sonographer. So there is some skill involved in that. When we look at these aneurysms with sort of 3D imaging such as CT, then we like to take a transverse or AP measurement that's perpendicular to the plane of the artery. That's done usually with a mixture of eyeballing and software, which can straighten out the vessel on CT imaging, but that's not available on ultrasound. So when you look at an ultrasound report, what we would look at is the maximal transverse diameter and not the length.
Yep. And so you've touched on this a little earlier, but when should a patient with a AAA be referred to a vascular surgeon?
Well, as I mentioned before, partly for small aneurysms is down to the comfort of the GP or the primary physician and the patient as to whether they want to see a vascular surgeon to have a discussion about what it all means and possibly long-term surveillance if they want the vascular surgeon to conduct that. But we would generally say that for an aneurysm in the range of 3 to 4 centimetres, there probably isn't a great deal of need for the patient to go and see a vascular surgeon because they're probably quite a long time away from having any potential surgery. When an aneurysm reaches 5 centimetres, then there needs to be a bit more of an active discussion and potentially a plan of management if the patient becomes symptomatic with pain or if they were to rupture. And part of that will be even a discussion about the patient's quality of life and life expectancy, because clearly if someone has a terminal cancer, for example, then you don't really want to be putting them through a major aneurysm repair. And if they were to rupture and present to hospital, then you probably don't want to put them through an emergency operation. So
yep.
I would generally say that if a patient is reaching, say, 4.5 centimetres, then that referral process should be initiated. When it reaches 5 centimetres to 5.5 centimetres, then there really should be an active discussion about when that patient should progress to surgery.
Indeed. And now, and if someone is at that sort of point of 5 to 5.5 where they think we're thinking about repair, the two options are open repair or endovascular repair. How does the surgeon decide which might be the most appropriate for a patient?
Well, Carolyn, we know that open repair carries a higher perioperative risk, so that's a risk of MI, stroke or death than endovascular repair. But it is a proven and durable procedure, and we would generally offer it to patients of a young age who have fairly low cardiovascular and anaesthetic risk. The other factor is that open repair can treat a wider range of morphology, so different shapes of aneurysms, whereas endovascular repair is reliant upon the stent taking on the shape of the aneurysm and achieving a good seal. So for some angulated aneurysms or aneurysms that progress above the renal arteries, then there are real limitations to the ability of endovascular repair to deal with them. So with increasing technology, we can actually treat some of those aneurysms anyway. The other thing about endovascular repair is that even though it has a lower perioperative risk, we know that up to 20% of patients will need to come back for a further procedure within the first 2 years. In most cases, these are very minor and they really just consist of an angiogram and possibly an extra stent, but in some cases they can be more significant. Given that the first endovascular graft was performed in 1996, we really only have limited durability data. We don't have many patients who have lived for, say, 20 years with these grafts in place. What we do have is increasing confidence as these devices go through each generation. And where perhaps 5 years ago we reserved endovascular repair for the older and sicker population, these days many vascular surgeons will have no hesitation in offering EVAR as an option to all of the patients that present with abdominal aortic aneurysms.
Yep. And the article also makes a point, particularly, as you know, mentioned EVAR is relatively a newer procedure. What sort of, if someone does have that, given we're not quite so sure about the long-term durability, what sort of follow-up do they then have?
Well, for endovascular aneurysm repair, we would generally follow quite a strict follow-up protocol of either a CT or a ultrasound and plain X-ray every 6 months. And that's looking for evidence of the graft migrating, so moving from its implanted position, which can compromise the graft. There are also some patients where we fail to achieve a seal and we see what's called an endoleak, which is a small leakage of blood and pressure into the remaining aneurysm sac outside the stent graft. And very rarely we can see actual fractures or damage to the stent structure of the graft. And those imaging protocols are quite reliable in terms of picking them up. So we would generally recommend follow-up every 6 months with one of those modalities for around 2 to 5 years. And then depending on how the patients perform, we'll probably scale them back over time. In terms of open repair, in the past we have had patients who we've discharged with no follow-up on the assumption that they will be fine and they've had a definitive repair. What we do also know about these patients is that a small proportion go on to develop further aneurysms above or below their previous repair and require further surgery. So I would usually recommend that someone having open repair would have a follow-up ultrasound at 2 to 5 years after open surgery and probably every 5 years after that. The other thing we find is that patients with a known AAA have increased risk of associated thoracic aortic aneurysms or popliteal aneurysms. And whilst there's no formal recommendations, I would usually screen those patients for a femoral or popliteal aneurysm and a thoracic aneurysm with an ultrasound of the leg and sometimes a non-contrast CT chest at some stage, either during their surveillance or follow-up.
Yep. So, sort of moving on, the article briefly talks about ruptures and dissections, which I think everyone knows are pretty awful and require very urgent referral and may well not do that well. But then the second article moves on to aneurysms that happen in other sites of the body, and you already mentioned popliteal and some others that might be found more commonly in people with triple A's. But thinking about aneurysms that are found either in the limbs or the splanchnic arteries, what are some key points for GPs to sort of bear in mind when they're considering or find one of those?
Well, I think that if we deal with popliteal or femoral popliteal aneurysms in the lower limbs, they would generally be asymptomatic unless they were to embolise. So clearly, if a patient has claudication or has a palpable lump behind the knee, then those aneurysms should be reviewed and operated upon. But if the GP is unsure, because sometimes this can be a complicated area, then an early referral is worthwhile, just so that the vascular surgeon can review the patient and discuss what the options are in terms of either surveillance or early surgery. And the same applies with visceral artery aneurysms, because again, the natural history of these varies depending on the location and associated conditions. And the options that we offer vary as well depending on the anatomical location. So because it is something that requires essentially a case-to-case view, if a splanchnic or a visceral artery aneurysm is encountered, I would probably recommend an early referral so the patient gets a definitive answer of what their plan is from a specialist.
Indeed. Yes, it's important to us, we have a big picture about the AAAs because they are far more common, but certainly as a key message to bear in mind about the others, earlier referral for an opinion is a excellent starting point. So thank you very much for talking to us today, and I'll just remind listeners that the two articles can be found in the June 2013 edition of Australian Family Physician. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you very much, Caroline.